Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Thank you very much for joining us. Before we get started on this week's podcast, a really exciting announcement. Peter Hart's book, The Gallipoli Evacuation, is now available to pre-order on our website. That's right, pre-order the book. It'll be out in September, but get your hands on a copy early because anyone who pre-orders the book will also receive an exclusive behind-the-scenes interview with Peter Hart that includes wonderful audio from Gallipoli veterans telling their story in their own words. It's absolutely extraordinary. In many ways, it's even more exciting than the book, but the book's pretty good too. So get your hands on the book, pre-order it now on our website, and get that exclusive interview that you can download straight away, and then you'll get the book when it comes out in September. So Peter Hart's The Gallipoli Evacuation, now available on the Living History website, which is livinghistorytv.com. That website again, livinghistorytv.com. Get your hands on the book. It's going to be something really special.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello and welcome to Living History. This week marks a very special anniversary in Australian military history in particular. It was the anniversary this week of the Battle of Fromelles. Now, we remember Fromelles as the first action that Australians took part in, the first major action Australians took part in on the Western Front, but also the most costly 24 hours in Australian military history. Just an absolute disaster, the Battle of Fromelles. And I thought a perfect opportunity to talk all about it and just remember those poor blokes who were killed or wounded on that terrible day 104 years ago. So joining me to talk about it is battlefield historian Pete Smith. Pete, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Good morning, Matt. Thanks so much. Nice to be with you again.
Now, you were saying you were at the battlefield of Fromelles just yesterday, mate. What was it like to be there and walking the ground, on the anniversary?
Well, it was quiet to start off with for very obvious reasons, but always very moving whenever I visit Fromelles, which is most weeks during the touring season, but not at the moment. So I hadn't been for a couple of months, so it was nice to get back onto the battlefield. But it was quiet, which is interesting as well, because it's not always quiet. And the harvesting had taken place, so it meant we could actually walk out onto the paddocks as well, which is not always easy to do. Sometimes it's ploughed and you can get out there. Sometimes the farmer isn't very happy if he's got his new crops in and seeds in. So it was nice and rather unusual to be able to walk right out onto the battlefield and take some. I took quite a lot of photographs from angles and directions that I wouldn't normally take them from, especially looking back towards VC Corner Cemetery, a very moving little cemetery right in the heart of the of no man's land, in fact. So it was good to be back and interesting and moving to be there on the 104th anniversary, of course, of the battle taking place.
Doesn't it always give you a unique perspective of a battlefield when you can get out in the fields? I mean, we tend to visit battlefields in motorized transport and we just get out and look at the memorials and the cemeteries and then back into the car or onto the bus. When you can get out and walk around, it gives it a whole new perspective, doesn't it?
It does, and sadly, it's one of the aspects of touring that we're always on fairly tight schedules, moving from A to B, and we like to try and get people out there onto to walk the ground. At the very least, what I always do, we stop the coach or my vehicle, depending on what type of what size tour it is, or the minibus, and we have a walk and discuss VC corner. And then we literally walk across the paddock if we can, or up the road, if not, across no man's land to the German frontline trenches, which is now the Cobbers Memorial Park. That allows the people at least to get an idea of that walk across the men. We're not walking, they were ducking and diving and running, but it really gives you a little bit more of a feel of the battlefield if you can get out on the ground and walk the landscape that the men actually walk themselves on.
Well, speaking of those men, why don't you give us an overview of exactly what happened at Fromelles 104 years ago?
It's a very interesting and terrible battle. I remember many years ago chatting to you, Matt, and saying that you didn't like particularly the battlefield and the feel of the battlefield. And I have to say, I understand why. It's because there's nothing laudable there. There's nothing to commemorate or celebrate. It's such a terrible action. So it takes place in the July 19th and 20th of July of 1916. And it's an attempt by the Haig and the British to try and trick the Germans into believing that there's going to be a serious assault taking place there using the Australian 5th Division and the British 61st Division. And the whole idea is to hold the reserves there. To hold the men there who may be transferred across to the Somme, because of course the Battle of the Somme is now into its 19th day. It started on the 1st. It's going okay in some areas and it's going terribly in others. So this is an important view to be an important way of holding German reserves. So hopefully we can have more success on the Somme battlefield. And interestingly, of course, the Australian 1st Division is just about to go into action on the 23rd of July. On the Somme battlefield. So in some ways it's helping the Australians, or it should be helping the Australians fighting that are due to fight on the Somme battlefield. So that's how it's linked to the Battle of the Somme. And sometimes people get a little confused and think it's a lot closer to the Somme battle than it is. In fact, it's quite some distance away. It would be over a day's, well over a day's march, and certainly transporting men, you couldn't easily transport men from El across to the Somme battlefield. But that's the idea, is to stop the Germans from moving men across to the Somme. This is a sad aspect. The Germans were never going to move men from the Somme because they never viewed the battle as being anything other than a feint. In other words, a trick. It was designed to trick the Germans, and they recognized that almost immediately. So you have to ask yourself, before we discuss the actual action, is why is it taking place? If everybody is fairly much aware that it's not going to work, it's not doing what it's supposed to do, why does it take place? Well, the simple answer is, and there is a simple answer, is that the 5th Division had not fought anywhere on the Western Front. It had been raised in Egypt, in that gap between the Gallipoli campaign and the move to the Western Front. And this is going to be its very first action. In fact, it was the last division to arrive in France. And yet it's going to be the first division to go into action. So there is a certain kudos attached from an Australian perspective, the 5th Division, the first one to go into action. So that's why it goes ahead, really. It's felt that the division needs to be, horrible term connected to fox hunting, bloody. It needs to be bloodied, and this is a good a place as any. Sadly, it's not a good a place as any, and that becomes very obvious when you're walking the ground. And when you walk on that walk from VC Corner across to the Cobbers Memorial Park, it is as flat as a pancake. It is totally flat. It's at sea level. There's the only ridge is well behind the German lines. That's known as the Aubers Ridge. Not even part of the objective. In fact, when they're not trying to break through, they're just trying to keep the Germans busy and hopefully hold the German reserves there. So there was no even attempt to get up to the Aubers Ridge. We're not even trying to actually take the village of Fromelles, which is on the Aubers Ridge. It's just taking the German first and second lines and keeping the pressure on them, hopefully holding reserves and perhaps even bringing some reserves to stop what is seen as a potential breakthrough.
They didn't even have proper trench lines, did they there, Pete, because of the nature of the ground? Tell us about this unusual setup for the trenches in the Fromelles region.
Yeah, the trenches are extraordinary. I'll just explain something. It's very interesting. When you're walking the ground, as I do an awful lot here, when I'm actually not, because this is my passion and hobby as well as my business, I walk the ground here a lot. And very unusually, when you walk the fields of Fromelles, you find the bullets in the fields, which you don't normally. If you imagine you pull the trigger on a rifle, your bullet goes whistling across the battlefield. If it doesn't hit anybody, it goes 3 miles away. But on the battlefield there, you find bullets everywhere. And there's a very good reason for that. It's because they're not fighting from trenches. They are fighting from behind walls. Because we're at sea level, because the ground is waterlogged, about 3 foot below the ground level, you're into the water table. So you cannot literally dig trenches. What you have to do is build walls. So 6 foot high walls or more, sandbagged, enormously thick. I mean, these were certainly the German fortifications, enormously well built. And we'll talk about that in a second, but well built fortifications, but all sandbagged. There's very little concrete. It's just sandbags. Again, concrete, not easy because you're mixing concrete in a waterlogged landscape. It's easier to fill sandbags and build your fortifications with sandbags. So we've got walls. That leads to another potential issue is that everybody knows where everybody is. If we went to the salient or the Somme, where you have more trenches or nothing for the salient and they're fighting from shell hole to shell hole, you're never clear where people are. But here, we knew where everybody was with aerial photography, but they also knew where we were. So they knew where our front line was based, where the men would jump out with assault from. We knew where the German front line was. We could see it. We knew roughly where their guns were, not accurately. But it means that there's no way you can hide anything. Everybody knows where everybody is during attack. Everybody knows how wide no man's land is. So it's a difficult battlefield. And then with little shelter, the only saving grace was because for almost a year there'd been no fighting here. When I say no fighting, no attempt to assault. There'd been fighting in the May of 1915, the Battle of the Aubers Ridge, a British battle, but nothing since then. So the landscape is green. It's very interesting. When we think of the First World War battlefields, what do we think of? Well, we think of mud and shell holes and craters and nothingness. Well, that is not the Battle of Fromelles. The Battle of Fromelles, the fields in between, the paddocks in between the two lines, were green. They had crops growing. They had a mixture of bulrushes, canola, wheat, barley, all intermingled and wild crops all growing. So there's an element of green. And that means that the men, if you dropped low enough and you kept moving, then you did have an element of cover. And interestingly, the first waves, the Australian first waves, heading towards what is now the Memorial Park, did well because they ran and they got through those crops before and low in the crops before the Germans could get their machine guns operational and the riflemen could stand up and open fire. So the Germans did lose a small section, which is now again where the Memorial Park is, of front line during the initial assaults. It's after that it becomes a nightmare because the Germans know where everybody's coming from and they bring fire to suppress those men trying to cross no man's land.
So tell us about that German reaction and what that meant for the Australians and the British troops in the German line.
Yeah, so to start off with, the guys that fought in there, what do you need when you're holding an enemy line? You need grenades, you need resupply, and that's what they're not going to get. And remember that very few of them got across, so that you're only talking of handfuls of small men in little groups trying to work together, trying to get reinforcements across. And one of the interesting things, and in fact, I only read this a few days ago, is the carrying parties, which are supposed to bring the equipment and the supplies, the grenades and the new bullets, for the rifles and for the machine guns across. Their task is to drop them off, go back, bring some more up. They didn't. When they got there, if they managed to survive crossing no man's land and they got to the Australian front line within the German trench systems, they stayed to help them because there were so few men. But what that meant was there were no men then going back to pick up more supplies to bring them. So constantly they're rummaging to try and find men in the Australian lines to load them up to try and get them across no man's land. And it's just leading to more and more casualties. But again, less men coming back because some are staying to fight, some are being killed. So they're not being resupplied in the front line. And the Germans put the squeeze on because they are taking very few casualties. The bombardments are ineffective. And that's possibly another of the most important aspects is the artillery was new to the Western Front. This is the Australian artillery of the 5th Division, supported by the 4th Division artillery. They were also here because they hadn't yet moved to the Somme. They were thought to be not trained well enough to move to the Somme, so they're left there. Well, there's a clue there, not trained well enough. Well, the artillery, apparently drop shots, a term that most infantrymen will know, there were an awful lot of drop shots dropping in the Australian front lines. because the gunners were not well enough trained, had no real idea of what they were shooting at because they'd not been given a proper brief. So the artillery barrage supposedly protecting the Australian infantry very, very poor. To counter that, or to as a juxtaposition to that, the German artillery barrage was very good. Well, there's a very good reason for that. The Germans have been there and been facing attacks for over a year. And so they know exactly where everything is. They can see the front lines. They know where they are. They've also got the added advantage of vision from the Auber's Ridge. So they can see the Australian front lines. They have plotted and spotted positions, machine gun positions, artillery positions. And so they bring down a very ferocious counter battery fire on the Australian batteries and frontline barrage on the Australian front line. So the men in the German trenches around the Cobbers Memorial Park slowly squeezed from both sides and having a really tough time. One of the more important positions on the whole of the battlefield is something called the Sugarloaf, sometimes wrongly described as a large blockhouse, giving you the impression that it had some extra height. It didn't. It is just a sandbag position again, but it's in a little salient. In other words, it juts out into no man's land. And the fire from the Sugarloaf swept obliquely, and we call it enfilade fire, across no man's land, and basically caused terrible damage to both the British 61st Division, because we also have to remember, this is not just an Australian attack. There is the British 61st Division is fighting on the right of the Australians, and it's having actually an appalling time with fire from the Sugarloaf as well. So the Sugarloaf, an actual key position on the battlefield, not taken. We couldn't get anywhere near it. It was just over 400 meters of no man's land to try and get to it. Just a terrible, terrible time to try and attack it. And it meant that those men trapped in no man's land had very little resupply, very little chance of even getting back, because, of course, that's what they're going to have to do eventually. They're going to have to recross no man's land and try and make it back to their own front line. And this flat landscape, this sweeping machine gun fire, meant that it seriously was an every man for himself. Of course, not everybody even attempts it. An awful lot of are already being killed or already have been captured. Over 400 Australians are actually captured during the fighting at Fromelles, where they cannot leave the German lines, are trapped there, and eventually will be taken prisoner.
It must be the worst scenario for infantrymen to be in, where they've charged across no man's land, they've survived that initial rush where a lot of their comrades have fallen, they've captured the enemy positions that they were supposed to capture, but then they're trapped there with Germans closing in on all sides. And the only way then to safety is that rush back across no man's land to their own line. It just must have been absolutely horrific for the blokes on the ground.
I mean, truly horrific. There were some monumental acts of bravery and courage taking place at this time. And one of them is from the pioneer sections here, who are desperately trying to dig a communication trench, which will run from the old Australian front line to their new front line in the German trenches. Because, of course, that's the key. If they can get a communication trench dug across no man's land, then men can, in some element of safety, get up the communication trench to the new front line. It was never completed, but they worked like billio to try and get this new communication trench across no man's land. And in fact, there is a godsend for it, because it became one of the ways that the wounded got back. They were able to crawl into this, even though it was very shallow, communication trench, and there the stretcher bearers were attempting to get the people that couldn't crawl back to their own front lines. But of course, there's no safety, because the Germans have a barrage constantly on their own front line. And for those that are making it independently, zigzagging across no man's land, trying to get back, there is one final terrible issue, is that they have to climb that wall. Because remember, there is a wall. This wall, which is our own front line, is still a wall. And it means that you've got to climb over that wall to drop back into your front line. And so very often German snipers were waiting for them and waited for that last as they climbed over the wall, thinking they'd made it all the way back across no man's land. The other thing to remember here is for the majority of these men, this is their first. There is an element of men who had fought on Gallipoli because of that splitting of some of the Gallipoli battalions in the 1st and 2nd Division to raise these battalions of the 5th Division. So there are Gallipoli men here, but they're not the bulk. The bulk of the men here have not seen combat. This is their first time of seeing combat. And what an introduction to the Western Front. I mean, truly terrible.
So what was the fate of most of these men that made it to the German line? What happened to them during the battle?
Yep. Well, the bulk of the men that fought, obviously the casualties, 5,533. We better go through that figure. It's an easy one to remember. But be aware, that is casualties. So that means that includes the missing. It includes the POWs, people that were captured. It includes the wounded and, of course, includes the dead. We use a broad brush for trying to work out the figures of the dead, and it's about a third. So about a third of the 5,533 were actually killed outright. But what happens to everybody else? I mean, we'll talk about what happens to the dead in a little while. But well, it's a case of trying to get back or surrendering. You know, the Australians, generally speaking, do not like surrendering, but sometimes you're left with no option. So you could surrender in the front line and hope for the best. And that is a hope, because things are not always as we'd like them to be in during any war, really. But the First World War being no exception, men trying to surrender very, very often were not allowed to. And certainly there are some accounts that the Germans were not keen on taking prisoners here. Why? Well, various reasons, but one of them, of course, this is the first time that they're actually fighting the Australians on the Western Front in a set-piece battle. And what you want to do is put the fear of God into your enemy. And if you then have a belief that you cannot surrender, you're going to be killed, then that's what it does. It puts the fear of God into you if you have to attack. So that may be why they weren't so keen on taking prisoners, but certainly there were not as many prisoners taken at Fromelles as perhaps there should have been. But again, 400 men captured. The ones wounded, they will be. They'll try and get through across no man's land, and they are still picking up wounded from no man's land 3 days later. They are still going out there, and we know about. Perhaps you don't, so I'll explain. There's a memorial within the Cobbers Memorial Park, and it's of Sergeant Fraser. And Sergeant Fraser is remembered there in the Memorial Park for going out repeatedly into no man's land during those days and bringing in wounded soldiers against orders. It was felt to be too dangerous for men to do that. So he's actually disobeying orders, going out there, picking up men and bringing them back. If you were got back behind your lines, if successfully recovered, then you enter the evacuation route. Again, no guarantee you're going to survive, because so many of the men were so badly hit by machine gun fire. And that is the big killer during this battle. Normally we say it's the artillery, but here it is most definitely machine gun fire, which is cutting the men down. So if you survive the actual action, then there's no guarantee. And over the years, I've followed the evacuation of many, many men, almost all the way to the coast, but sadly still not surviving, dying days, weeks, sometimes later of the wounds received at Fromelles. In fact, months later. I took a family around many years ago where their relative had died 4 months later. He'd never been well enough to leave France, and he died and he's buried in ruin. A terrible time for those that are surviving and trying to get off the battlefield. The difficulty, of course, is going to be, how do we get the dead? What do we do with the dead? Do we recover the dead? How do we recover the men in no man's land of the trapped? Well, to be truthful, some could never be recovered, and some just died there. They were never got to. But for those that were killed outright, then they lay in no man's land. And the difficulty here is, no man's land will always be no man's land. And I mean, for the whole of the Great War, it will be no man's land. There is no attempt ever to take the German trenches from then on. So it means that those lines became static. They are going to be manned for the whole of the war by units facing each other, but no man's land will always be there. So the men that were left in no man's land, one of the things that was done during patrols in the next coming, well, years, literally, but months more importantly, patrols were tasked to remove the belongings and identity discs from the men that lay in no man's land. Now, that's great in some ways and not so great in others, because it's going to give closure to families, because they will then at last know that their relative is dead. And most of them would have suspected within months that their relatives may be dead. Some will not. Some will never give up hope. But for those that their identities recovered, their private belongings recovered, and in fact sent home in some cases, then this was the confirmation that they're dead. Move fast forward to the end of the war and the battlefield clearances, and these poor guys are still on the surface. They're still there. They've never been buried because it was always impossible. But sadly, they now are going to become part of that enormous unknown, because their belongings, their private belongings and their identity discs and their paybooks, in fact. And that's an interesting comment. The Australians attacked at Fromelles carrying their paybooks. In later actions, they were not. Paybooks are handed in before you go into action, but they were carrying their paybooks when they went into action. All of that's been removed from their bodies. So what we end up with is enormous numbers of unknown soldiers being recovered and buried after the war. Of course, there's another issue. Immediately after the fighting, the Germans are hoping for a truce. I'm sure that many Australians were hoping for some kind of parley, some kind of period when we could clear the battlefield. It's never going to happen. So the Germans are left with another issue. There's an awful lot of dead Australians very close to their front line. And those bodies are starting to cause problems with flies hideously. And so it's felt that something has to be done. And so the Germans start to bury Australian dead themselves. And they remove their men, the men that can recover. And of course, they're not going to risk the living to bury the dead. So it's only clearing the battlefield that they can get to. And it's that area around the Memorial Park, where the Memorial Park now is, should I say. It's the areas that are very close to the German front line. And it's those Australians that made it into the German trenches. And they are going to be buried by the Germans.
Well, that's the interesting recent part of the story, isn't it, Pete? The mass grave that was discovered in Fromelles. Tell us about the eccentric Melbourne schoolteacher Lambis and Glazos and the discovery of the mass grave at Fromelles.
Yeah, well, Lambis very much is on, a small private kind of campaign to try and ensure that as many Australians, no matter where, not just here on the Western Front, but no matter where, whose remains are still out there somewhere, are recovered and are eventually buried. Of course, they cannot be taken back to Australia. That system is still in place, and I think quite rightly that they are buried close to where they fell. And he was aware that there were many, and there are many, many mass graves on the Western Front, but he felt it shouldn't be too difficult to locate the mass graves around Fromelles, where the Germans had buried the soldiers. Now, how do we know to start off with? And this is quite a long talk, so I'll try and abbreviate it. We know because the Germans, when they identified some of the soldiers that they buried, they sent their belongings home and actually told the Red Cross, this is all done via the Red Cross in Geneva, and they told the Red Cross that they were burying Australian soldiers from the Battle of Fromelles, and these were some of the belongings and some of the names of those that they'd buried. So we knew that there was a mass grave or several mass graves, multiple mass graves close to Fromelles. Lambis decided that he would do some research. The easiest way of researching is aerial photography. I'm probably simplifying his research, which was very studious and long-winded, but he located aerial photography, which showed, this is British aerial photography of the German lines, which showed the Germans digging holes, digging burial pits, effectively. From that, he then went and used came out to France, organized that with the farmer and others, to use a metal detector just on that area, and he found some very important and interesting relics on the surface, which gave him a really good feel that there was a mass grave below. He then had to persuade the Australian government to fund a test dig, because, of course, the Commonwealth War Graves does not get involved until the bodies are actually found. The Commonwealth War Graves will help. In this case, it's going to be a private company that recovers them. But that is their job, the Commonwealth War Graves, to bury and to create the cemetery to take them, which is the new cemetery that we now have just on the outskirts of Fromelles, Pheasant Wood. And that is where having the test pit was successful. An archaeological company was brought in to oversee and organise the exhumation of the men there. We eventually get 250 bodies recovered from the mass grave. We probably expected more, but 250 was the number that was recovered, and they are now all lying in Pheasant Wood. And this is where it gets interesting. a DNA profile was taken of every single body as they were buried. So effectively, they were originally all buried as unknown soldiers. But a DNA profile was taken, and then what we have is the first mass use of DNA, where adverts placed all over Australia. Have you a relative that died during the Battle of Fromelles and is missing? If so, could you come and donate DNA? That is still ongoing. And so we have now, of the 250, I think it's 160. I think we're 250. Does that sound right, Matt?
Yeah, I think that's about right. It's over 160.
I think it's 160. Yeah. I think it's nearing 160. I think 160 men have now been identified with the use of DNA. So it's fantastic. Very laudable, I have to say. I'm not so sure if I'd have been quite so happy if we just had a cemetery full of unknown Australian soldiers. But it works. This whole system works in this case. And I think, I think over a period of time, they are still taking DNA. I've taken people around the battlefield in recent months prior to the lockdown who should have donated DNA and hadn't. And so I think there's still potential for many more to be identified, and I hope it will continue. But I can see a time when of the 250, over 200 will be identified, which is just extraordinary and shows you what DNA can do when you have a target group. And that's the key here, a small target group, i.e. men that died on the 19th, Australian men that died on the 19th and 20th of July 1916 and are unknown. In other words, they have no known grave. Then come forward. If you have a relative, then come forward with your DNA, and you may be successful, as many have been.
It's just an extraordinary story, and I should say, if you're listening to this, that about a year ago I did a full interview with Lambis and Glazos about the Fromelles story, and it's absolutely extraordinary the lengths he went to convince the government that they should dig and to just never give up. And he's now doing that in other battlefields around the world. So it's an extraordinary story. So go back and listen to that interview with Lambis about the Battle of Fromelles. Pete, you mentioned at the top of the interview, you mentioned walking the ground. And obviously this is something that I think is essential. And I know you agree with me that getting out and actually walking in the footsteps of the men is essential. Just talk to me about walking the ground at Fromelles, because it is an interesting battlefield. There are a couple of very interesting memorials there. Just tell us about that experience of walking the ground.
It is. I think it's probably, I have to say, it's probably, if not my favourite battlefield to walk, because it is so very, very visible. Everything is visible. And so long as you know which way you're looking and you have a good map or information or a guide, in fact, with you, then it's all there. It's not been built upon. It's still exactly as it was. The farms are even in the same places. The villages have not really grown in the area. It's exactly the same. There's no kind of planting of woods that spoil your view or anything. So you can literally start in the Australian frontline positions. And there's a little stream called I think it's called a Lays. I'm just not quite sure how you pronounce it. I suspect it's probably Lay. But there's a little stream, sometimes described as a river. It's a big ditch, really. What it is, it's a drainage ditch, because, of course, this landscape needs drainage ditches to keep the water flowing. So you can start there, and that was in some areas just in front of the Australian lines. In other areas, it's just behind. So it's an interesting place to start. And you can literally walk up the road, as I say, when the ploughing's being done, or when the seeds are not in, or when it's just been harvested, as it was yesterday. You can walk across that battlefield, and you get a real, real sense of what it was like. I also, when I have student groups especially, I go into the VC Corner Cemetery, a very, very moving cemetery, because it is in no man's land, just in front of the Australian frontline positions. And it's got walls around it, and those walls are, I suppose, 4 foot high. And I get my student groups to crouch down below the walls, as if they're in the frontline trenches, and then to stand up and imagine they were going to climb over the wall and then jump down into no man's land and head off towards the. And it's chilling. It is really chilling when I literally blow a whistle and get to stand up and imagine they're climbing over the wall. And it really makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. And then off we go. And when we can, we form a line and we just walk across across those paddocks towards the German lines. If you raise your eyes, you can actually see the flags with the Australian flag and the French flag flying side by side with Sergeant Fraser there and the wounded soldier over his shoulder. In front of you and beyond it in the distance on top of that ridge that is very difficult to make out, but you eventually can just about see that ridge, you can see the church of Fromelles. If you look slightly right, you're looking to Aubers. And for the British, it was known as their battle was known as the Fighting of the Aubers Ridge. And that is what the ridge is known. It's the Aubers Ridge. It links the two villages. And there you can see it in front of you on the horizon. It's only 25 meters above sea level. So just 25 meters above sea level. It's a little blip in the landscape, but an important blip for the Germans. And so on we go, walking across. If you have the time, you can walk all the way into Fromelles through the Cobbers Memorial Park, past a little private memorial to a British officer who was lost there in 1915, past Sergeant Bramble's memorial, a fighter pilot, overlapping history, a fighter pilot sergeant who was shot down in his Spitfire in 1941. And then into Fromelles itself and to the very, very lovely, important and interesting museum that's now being created in Fromelles. We can go and have a look at that and then walk into the town, into the church itself. If you have more time, you can go and look at where Hitler served. There's a bunker where Hitler served. So you can visit the bunker and you can walk up onto the top of the ridge and look back from the top of the ridge, from the Aubers Ridge, and look back across to the battlefield itself. So walking is, you can spend a day. You could probably spend more than a day there, but a day walking, crisscrossing the battlefield and looking at various aspects of it. The one thing you can't get to is to that Sugarloaf, because it is slap bang in the middle of a paddock, so we can't get to it unless, like yesterday, I was lucky. Now, I couldn't even get to it yesterday. I got nearly to it, and then the crops changed, and they hadn't harvested where I wanted to be, so I didn't quite get to where it was. And it is quite difficult to point out. In fact, I had a request yesterday of somebody said, Pete, could you send me a picture of the Sugarloaf? So I aimed the camera in the right direction and it's over there somewhere, but it is just a little difficult to actually plot exactly unless you've got something like Linesman, which is a very technical bit of kit that you can load up onto a piece, an iPad or something and actually plot exactly where it is. But without that, a little difficult to spot exactly where the Sugarloaf was.
The couple of times I've managed to get to the Sugarloaf when I've been at Fromelles, the way that I knew I was there was because of the German machine gun cartridges that were scattered around on the ground when I arrived. So that was a fair indicator that I was in the heart of that deadly German defensive position.
It's fascinating, Matt, isn't it? You would think that with over 100 years of ploughing that they would be dispersed and moved, and they're just not. I think the furrows just fold them one way, then they fold them the other way, then they fold them back again, and they just don't go anywhere. And in fact, funny enough, my little lad who's five, he picked up three cartridges altogether, all German, all fired, when we were doing that walk across to where the Sugarloaf was. So we'd obviously crossed through another German position where there'd been something, machine gun or a rifleman firing away. And that's one of the other slightly disturbing, and some people do find it disturbing, I find it fascinating, but there are a lot of artifacts on that battlefield because of that very reason, because people were not removed for a long time from the battlefield and because it was static for the whole of the war, then the landscape is fairly saturated in relics from spent rounds and cartridges. And the day-to-day belongings of the soldiers that fought and died there are commonly brought to the surface during the ploughing season.
And sadly, human remains as well. It's not unusual at Fromelles to find, a thigh bone or just obviously not whole skeletons, but just fragmentary parts of human beings, which is probably the most confronting thing you can find on a battlefield.
It is, and the one that I, the most common ones are the smaller bones, so toes and fingers you see quite often, but teeth, they give me the heebie-jeebies. I have to say, having walked the battlefield for many, many years, teeth, I don't like teeth. And sadly, they survive because they're small and they don't deteriorate. Teeth are one of nature's kind of almost indestructible things. So you find them there. It's very, 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 very sad. There's an interesting, I'm just going to shoot off on a complete tangent. The Commonwealth War Graves did not recover fragmentary remains for many, many years. That's not what they did. If fragmentary remains were found in a paddock that's being ploughed, then they were not recovered. And they've just started doing it. You can now collect fragmentary remains, and they are creating little graves all over the battlefield, which are being used for burying fragments of people. in the past, and it just says, I can't remember the wording exactly on it. And in fact, you may have seen it, Matt. I'm not sure. There's one in Polygon Wood. They just created one in Polygon, in Butts New British Cemetery. In Butts New British Cemetery at Polygon Wood, there is now a little grave that says, now I'm not going to quote it because I'm not sure. It's something like fragmentary remains or words to that effect.
Just extraordinary, isn't it? That's the most confronting part of a battlefield, when you find those little pieces of what was once a human being. And on that subject, Pete, why does Fromelles still speak to us after all this time?
We haven't talked about it, and of course there is an aspect of this that perhaps we should mention, that obviously this is perceived by a lot of Australians as with an element of truth, a bad British leadership here. And it is. There's a lot of very, very bad decision-making going on here. This battle should not have taken place. And I just scribbled down actually some notes last night. This gives you an idea of how this is. I mean, this is, in the greater picture of the Western Front, this is a tiny, tiny, tiny part. And it's, and the great battle of the Somme is taking place. It is literally the side action going on. So it's not important. I know losses are appalling. You know, the worst losses in 24 hours in Australian military history. But in the greater picture, it's a tiny aspect of the fighting. So I'll just quickly scribble this down. This is when this is being planned. And it's basically a chap called Haking that is the instigator and designer, along with Monroe, who is his boss effectively. And it goes up to Haig, and Haig kind of approves it to start off with. And then Haig, because he perceives it may not be doing anything, it may not actually work, it may not hold the German reserves there. So Haig's headquarters before the battle suggests cancelling it. We then get some bad weather. And Haking, who has not actually cancelled it, then thinks, well, we better postpone it at the very least. Then Monroe, who is Haking's boss, advocates that it should be cancelled because he perceives that now with the bad weather and everything, and that Haig has suggested that perhaps wasn't any point. Monroe then says, yeah. And then when they're just about to cancel it, Haig comes back again, or Haig's headquarters comes back again and says, actually, we now think it might be a good thing to proceed because we can perceive that the Germans are just about to do a counterattack on the Somme. So perhaps it's a good idea. So it's wishy-washy, even in the policy of whether it should take place or whether it shouldn't. So I suppose that's what we should remember to start off with, is bad planning, bad preparation. Those terrible losses, 5,533, I'm going to say it again, only because I can remember it straightforward. Now, we should remember, those are appalling losses, worst 24 hours in Australian military history, or Australian history, really. And we should remember all those men that were lost. They're part of many, many more who are going to be lost. But, you know, just 24 hours of just horror, really. It's a destruction of the 5th Division in its first action. You know, the 5th Division will not be ready for months and months to go back into action anywhere. So here it is. You can imagine all that effort, that time and effort in the training of them, in the gathering of the men, in preparing them to come to the Western Front, in bringing them from Egypt to the Western Front, and just squandered in their very first action. I have to say the same for the British 61st Division. Not as many casualties by any means. And I'm just going to just leap back to the fighting itself, and that's partly due to a difference in the attacking. How they attacked. I've talked about those walls in the frontline trenches. Well, for Australians, they climbed over the walls. They went over the walls, climbed up the scaling ladders, over the parapet, into no man's land, and off they went. The British didn't do that. The British decided to cut gaps in their parapet. They created what are called sally ports, openings in the parapet that the men rushed out in small groupings and then spread out. Now, because of that, the Germans could see those gaps, and they mowed them down as they tried to get out through their gaps. And the British attack actually stalled and then stopped, and then was cancelled so that any more should assault. Now, that didn't happen to the Australians, A, because they didn't get the information properly, but B, because the nature of the way that they were assaulting by climbing over the walls meant that actually was a little bit more successful. So the British stopped meant they have far less casualties, thankfully, than the Australians. So back to your initial question, why should we remember it? We should remember it for the terrible losses. We should remember it for the terrible bravery of the men that you have to say, because of what is going on, subsequent waves of men trying to cross no man's land fairly much knew what was going to happen to them, and yet still they went. So we should remember that bravery. We should remember Sergeant Fraser, as we do, because he's commemorated by that memorial in the Memorial Park. He's also, as a matter of interest, his memorial was recast, and you'll find him in Melbourne as well. On the way to the shrine in Melbourne, there is a second casting of him carrying his wounded comrade across no man's land. So we should remember that bravery. We should remember him, and we should also realize that we need more planning. And I think that's what I take from it more than anything else. It is part of this learning curve, a horrible, steep learning curve that has to take place during the First World War that will eventually lead to the successful attacks of 1918. But this attack is appalling. Remember, I think one of the other things that you have to remember, which I find fascinating, is we are very close to a lot of changes taking place, and they will take place on the Somme. Night attacks, creeping barrages, tanks, men not attacking in lines, attacking in artillery formation, which means basically an arrowhead. So all of these are going to start to take place during the Somme fighting, but we're just too early. None of them have been developed yet properly. They're being developed, and none of them will be used. We haven't mentioned the attack time, 6:15 in the evening on a beautiful summer's day. It's not going to go dark. I was just reading an account that said it went dark 2 hours later, but it doesn't go dark till 10 o'clock. So it's 4 hours, 4 hours of bright sunshine trying to cross no man's land. And that's what should be remembered is that grit of men going across in bright sunshine, not dark, not half light, not gloom. This is bright sunshine on a beautiful July morning in 1916. Terrible.
Well, Pete, it's an important battle to remember. And, you know, for all those reasons you mentioned, it's really important we don't forget. And on this week, every year, we remember those brave souls who fought and died at Fromelles. But just thank you so much for joining us and painting that picture. It's been really wonderful. And I always love getting on the show. And we'll definitely get you back again in the future to talk about more battlefields.
No, it's a pleasure, Matt. It's a shame you went with me yesterday when we walked the ground. It'd been nice to have had you walking the ground with me.
Well, I can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to actually getting back to the battlefields when we're allowed to travel. It'll be a while off yet, but as soon as we're able to, I'll be back over there, mate, to walk some battlefields and share a cold beer with you.
Brilliant. Looking forward to it.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.